Welcome to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, Tom Bacon continues his reading from the writings of Mark Twain. This from Old Times on the Mississippi, Twain's recollections from his time as a riverboat captain on the Mississippi River.
This chapter of Old Times on the Mississippi is called The River Rises. During this big rise, these small fry craft were an intolerable nuisance. We were running chute after chute, a new world to me, and if there was a particularly cramped place in a chute, we would be pretty sure to meet a broadhorn there, and if he failed to be there, we'd find him in still a worse locality, namely the head of the chute on the shoal water. Then there'd be no end of profane cordialities exchanged. Sometimes in the big river, when we'd be feeling our way cautiously along through a fog, the deep hush would suddenly be broken by yells and a clamor of tin pans, and all in an instant a log raft would appear vaguely through the webby veil close upon us. And then we did not wait to swap knives, but snatched our engine bells out by the roots and piled on all the steam we had to scramble out of the way. One doesn't hit a rock or a solid log raft with a steamboat when he can get excused. You'll hardly believe it, but many steamboat clerks always carried a large assortment of religious tracts with them in those old departed steamboating days. Indeed, they did. 20 times a day, we'd be cramping up around a bar while a string of those small fry rascals were drifting down into the head of the bend way above and beyond us a couple of miles. Now, a skiff would dart away from one of them and come fighting its laborious way across the desert of water. It would ease all in the shadow of our forecastle, and the panting oarsman would shout, "Gimme a paper!" as the skiff drifted swiftly astern. The clerk would throw over a file of New Orleans journals. If those were picked up without comment, you might notice that now a dozen other skiffs had been drifting down upon us without saying anything. You understand, they had been waiting to see how number one was going to fare. Number one, making no comment, all the rest would bend to their oars and come on now, and as fast as they came, the clerk would heave over neat bundles of religious tracts tied to shingles. The amount of hard swearing which 12 packages of religious literature will command when impartially divided up among 12 raftsmen crews who have pulled a heavy skiff 2 miles on a hot day to get them is simply incredible. As I've said, the big rise brought a new world under my vision. By the time the river was over its banks, we had forsaken our old paths and were hourly climbing over bars that had stood 10 feet out of the water before. We were shaving stumpy shores like that at the foot of Madrid Bend, which I had always seen avoided before. We were clattering through chutes like that of 82, where the opening at the foot was an unbroken wall of timber, till our nose was almost at the very spot. Some of those chutes were utter solitudes. The dense, untouched forest overhung both banks of the crooked little crack, and one could believe that human creatures had never intruded there before. The swinging grapevines, the grassy nooks and vistas glimpsed as we swept by, the flowering creepers waving their red blossoms from the tops of dead trunks, and all the spendthrift richness of the forest foliage were wasted and thrown away there. The chutes were lovely places to steer in. They were deep, except at the head. The current was gentle. Under the points, the water was absolutely dead, and the invisible banks so bluff that where the tender willow thickets projected, you could bury your boat's broadside in them as you tore along, and then you seemed fairly to fly. Behind other islands, we found wretched little farms and wretcheder little log cabins. There were crazy rail fences sticking a foot or two above the water, with one or two jeans-clad, chill-racked, yellow-faced male miserables roosting on the top rail, elbows on knees, jaws in hands, grinding tobacco and discharging the resultant floating chips through crevices left by lost teeth. While the rest of the family and the few farm animals were huddled together in an empty wood flat riding at her moorings close at hand. In this flatboat, the family would have to cook and eat and sleep for a lesser or greater number of days, or possibly even weeks, until the river should fall 2 or 3 feet and let them get back to their log cabins and their chills again, chills being a merciful provision of an all-wise providence to enable them to take exercise without exertion. And this sort of watery camping out was a thing which these people were rather liable to be treated to a couple of times a year, by the December rise out of the Ohio and by the June rise out of the Mississippi. And yet these were kindly dispensations, for they at least enabled the poor things to rise from the dead now and then and look upon life when a steamboat went by. They appreciated the blessings, too, for they spread their mouths and eyes wide open and made the most of these occasions. Now, what could these banished creatures find to do to keep from dying of the blues during the low water season? Once, in one of these lovely island chutes, we found our course completely bridged by a great fallen tree. This will serve to show how narrow some of those chutes were. The passengers had an hour's recreation in a virgin wilderness while the boat hands chopped the bridge away, for there was no such thing as turning back, you comprehend. From Cairo to Baton Rouge, when the river's over its banks, you have no particular trouble in the night, for a 1,000-mile wall of dense forest that guards the two banks all the way is only gapped with a farm or a woodyard opening at intervals, so you can't get out of the river much easier than you could get out of a fenced lane. But from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, it's a different matter. The river is more than a mile wide and very deep, as much as 200 feet in places. Both banks, for a good deal over 100 miles, are shorn of their timber and bordered by continuous sugar plantations, with only here and there a scattering sapling or a row of ornamental china trees. The timber is shorn off clear to the rear of the plantations from 2 to 4 miles. When the first frost threatens to come, the planters snatch off their crops in a hurry. When they've finished grinding the cane, they form the refuse of the stalks, which they call bagasse, into great piles and set fire to them. Though in other sugar countries, the bagasse is used for fuel in the furnaces of the sugar mills. Now, the piles of damp bagasse burn slowly and smoke like Satan's own kitchen. An embankment 10 or 15 feet high guards both banks of the Mississippi all the way down that lower end of the river, and the embankment is set back from the edge of the shore from 10 to perhaps 100 feet, according to circumstances. Say 30 or 40 feet is a general thing. Fill that whole region with an impenetrable gloom of smoke from 100 miles of burning bagasse piles when the river's over the banks, and turn a steamboat loose along there at midnight and see how she'll feel. And see how you'll feel, too. You find yourself way out in the midst of a vague, dim sea that is shoreless, that fades out and loses itself in the murky distances, for you cannot discern the thin rib of embankment. And you're always imagining you see a straggling tree when you don't. The plantations themselves are transformed by the smoke and look like part of the sea. All through your watch, you're tortured with the exquisite misery of uncertainty. You hope you're keeping in the river, but you do not know. All that you're sure about is that you're likely to be within 6 feet of the bank and destruction when you think you're a good half mile from shore. And you're sure also that if you chance suddenly to fetch up against the embankment and topple your chimneys overboard, you'll have the small comfort of knowing that it is about what you were expecting to do. One of the great Vicksburg packets darted out into a sugar plantation one night at such a time and had to stay there for a week. But there was no novelty about it. It had been done often before. I thought I had finished this chapter, but I wish to add a curious thing while it's on my mind. It is only relevant in that it's connected with piloting. There used to be an excellent pilot on the river, a Mr. X, who was a somnambulist. It was said that if his mind was troubled about a bad piece of river, he was pretty sure to get up and walk in his sleep and do strange things. He was once a fellow pilot for a trip or two with George Ealer on a great New Orleans passenger packet. During a considerable part of the first trip, George was uneasy, but he got over it by and by, as X seemed content to stay in his bed when asleep. Well, late one night, the boat was approaching Helena, Arkansas. The water was low, and the crossing above the town in a very blind and tangled condition. X had seen the crossing since Ealer had, and as the night was particularly drizzly, sullen, and dark, Ealer was considering whether he had better not have X called to assist in running the place, when the door opened and X walked in. Now, on very dark nights, light is a deadly enemy to piloting. You're aware that if you stand in a lighted room on such a night, you cannot see things in the street to any purpose. But if you put out the lights and stand in the gloom, you can make out objects in the street pretty well. So on very dark nights, pilots do not smoke. They allow no fire in the pilot house stove. If there's a crack which can allow the least ray to escape, they order the furnaces to be curtained with huge tarpaulins and the skylights to be closely blinded. Then no light whatever issues from the boat. The undefinable shape that now entered the pilot house had Mr. X's voice. This said, "Let me take her, George. I've seen this place since you have, and it's so crooked I reckon I can run it myself easier than I could tell you how to do it." "Well, it is kind of you, and I swear I am willing. I haven't got another drop of perspiration left in me. I've been spinning around and around the wheel like a squirrel. It's so dark I can't even tell which way she's swinging till she's coming around like a whirligig." So Ealer took a seat on the bench, panting and breathless. The black phantom assumed the wheel without saying anything, steadied the waltzing steamer with a turn or two, and then stood at ease, coaxing her a little to this side and then to that, as gently and sweetly as if the time had been noonday. When Ealer observed this marvel of steering, he wished that he had not confessed. He stared and wondered and finally said, "Well, I thought I knew how to steer a steamboat, but that was another mistake of mine." X said nothing. He went serenely on with his work. He rang for the leads. He rang to slow down the steam. He worked the boat carefully and neatly into invisible marks, then stood at the center of the wheel and peered blandly out into the blackness fore and aft to verify his position. As the leads shoaled more and more, he stopped the engines entirely, and the dead silence and suspense of drifting followed. When the shoalest water was struck, he cracked on the steam, carried her handsomely over, then began to work her warily into the next system of shoal marks. The same patient, heedful use of leads and engines followed. The boat slipped through without touching bottom and entered upon the third and last intricacy of the crossing. Imperceptibly she moved through the gloom, crept by inches into her marks, drifted tediously until the shoalest water was cried, and then, under a tremendous head of steam, went swinging over the reef and away into deep water in safety. Ealer let his long, pent breath pour in a great relieving sigh and said, "That's the sweetest piece of piloting that was ever done on the Mississippi River. I wouldn't believe it could be done if I hadn't seen it." There was no reply. He added, "Just hold her 5 minutes longer, partner, and let me run down and get a cup of coffee." A minute later, Ealer was biting into a pie down in the Texas and comforting himself with coffee. Just then, the night watchman happened in and was about to happen out again when he noticed Ealer and exclaimed, "Who's at the wheel, sir?" "X." "Dart for the pilot house, quicker than lightning." The next moment, both men were flying up to the pilot house companionway, 3 steps at a jump, nobody there. The great steamer was whistling down the middle of the river at her own sweet will. The watchman shot out of the place again. Ealer seized the wheel, set an engine back with power, and held his breath while the boat reluctantly swung away from a towhead, which she was about to knock into the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. By and by, the watchman came back and said, "Didn't that lunatic tell you he was asleep when he first came up here?" "No." "Well, he was. I found him walking along on top of the railings just as unconcerned as another man would walk along a pavement. And I put him to bed, now just this minute. There he was again, away astern, going through that sort of tightrope deviltry the same as before. Well, I think I'll stay by next time he has one of those fits, but I hope he'll have them often. You just ought to have seen him take this boat through the Helena Crossing. I never saw anything so gaudy before. And if he can do such gold-leaf, kid-glove, diamond breastpin piloting when he's sound asleep, what couldn't he do if he was dead?" This chapter in Old Times on the Mississippi is called Sounding. When the river is very low and one steamboat is drawing all the water there is in the channel, or a few inches more, as was often the case in old times, one must be painfully circumspect in his piloting. We used to have to sound a number of particularly bad places almost every trip when the river was at a very low stage. Sounding is done in this way. The boat ties up at the shore just above the shoal crossing. The pilot not on watch takes his cub, or steersman, and a picked crew of men, sometimes an officer also, and goes out in the yawl, provided the boat has not that rare and sumptuous luxury, a regularly devised sounding boat, and proceeds to hunt for the best water. The pilot on duty watching his movements through a spyglass meantime, and in some instances assisting by signals if the boat's whistle signifying try higher up or try lower down. For the surface of the water, like an oil painting, is more expressive and intelligible when inspected from a little distance than very close at hand. The whistle signals are seldom necessary, however, never perhaps except when the wind confuses the significant ripples upon the water's surface. When the yawl has reached the shoal place, the speed is slackened, the pilot begins to sound the depth with a pole 10 or 12 feet long, and the steersman at the tiller obeys the order to hold her up to starboard, or let her fall off to larboard, or steady, steady as you go. When the measurements indicate that the yawl is approaching the shoalest part of the reef, the command is given to ease all. Then the men stop rowing and the yawl drifts with the current. The next order is stand by with the buoy. The moment the shallowest point is reached, the pilot delivers the order, let go the buoy, and over she goes. If the pilot is not satisfied, he sounds the place again. If he finds better water higher up or lower down, he removes the buoy to that place. Being finally satisfied, he gives the order, and all the men stand their oars straight up in the air in line. A blast from the boat's whistle indicates the signal's been seen. Then the men give way on their oars and lay the yawl alongside the buoy. The steamer comes creeping carefully down, is pointed straight at the buoy, husbands her power for the coming struggle, and presently, at the critical moment, turns on all her steam and goes grinding and wallowing over the buoy in the sand and gains the deeper water beyond. Or maybe she doesn't. Maybe she strikes and swings. Then she has to while away several hours or even days sparring herself off. Sometimes a buoy is not laid at all, but the yawl goes ahead, hunting the best water, and the steamer follows along in its wake. Often there's a deal of fun and excitement about sounding, especially if it's a glorious summer day or a blustering night. But in winter, the cold and the peril take most of the fun out of it. A buoy is nothing but a board 4 or 5 feet long with one end turned up. It's a reversed schoolhouse bench with one of the supports left and the other removed. It's anchored on the shoalest part of the reef by a rope with a heavy stone made fast to the end of it. But for the resistance of the turned-up end of the reversed bench, the current would pull the buoy underwater. At night, a paper lantern with a candle in it is fastened on top of the buoy, and this can be seen a mile or more, a little glimmering spark in the waste of blackness. Nothing delights a cub so much as the opportunity to go out sounding. There's such an air of adventure about it. Often there's danger. It's so gaudy and man-of-war-like to sit up on the stern sheets and steer a swift yawl. There's something fine about the exultant spring of the boat when an experienced old sailor crew throw their souls into the oars. It's lovely to see the white foam stream away from the bows. There's music in the rush of the water. It is deliciously exhilarating in summer to go speeding over the breezy expanses of the river when the world of wavelets is dancing in the sun. It's such grandeur, too, to the cub, to give a chance to give an order, for often the pilot will simply say, let her go about, and leave the rest to the cub, who instantly cries in his sternest tone of command, ease starboard, strong on the larboard, starboard give way, with a will, men. The cub enjoys sounding for the further reason that the eyes of the passengers are all watching the yawl's movements with absorbing interest if the time be daylight, and if it be night, he knows that those same wondering eyes are fastened upon the yawl's lantern as it glides out into the gloom and dims away in the remote distance. One trip, a pretty girl of 16 spent her time in our pilot house with her uncle and aunt every day and all day long. I fell in love with her. So did Mr. Thornburg's cub, Tom G. Tom and I had been bosom friends until this time, but now a coolness began to arise. I told the girl a good many of my river adventures and made myself out to be a good deal of a hero. Tom tried to make himself appear to be a hero, too, and succeeded to some extent, but then he always had a way of embroidering. However, virtue is its own reward, so I was a barely perceptible trifle ahead in the contest. About this time, something happened which promised handsomely for me. The pilots decided to sound the crossing at the head of 21. This would occur about 9 or 10 o'clock at night when the passengers would still be up. It would be Mr. Thornburg's watch, therefore my chief would have to do the sounding. We had a perfect love of a sounding boat, long, trim, graceful, and as fleet as a greyhound. Her thwarts were cushioned. She carried 12 oarsmen. One of the mates was always sent in her to transmit orders to her crew, for ours was a steamer where no end of style was put on. We tied up at the shore above 21 and got ready. It was a foul night, and the river was so wide there that a landsman's uneducated eye could discern no opposite shore through such a gloom. The passengers were alert and interested. Everything was satisfactory. As I hurried through the engine room, picturesquely gotten up in storm toggery, I met Tom, and could not forbear delivering myself of a mean speech. "Ain't you glad you don't have to go out sounding?" Tom was passing on, but he quickly turned and said, "Now just for that, you can go and get the sounding pole yourself. I was going after it, but I'd see you in Halifax now afore I'd do it." "Who wants you to get it?" "I don't. It's in the sounding boat." "It ain't either. It's been new painted. It's been up on the ladies' cabin guard 2 days drying." I flew back and shortly arrived among the crowd of watching and wondering ladies just in time to hear the command, "Give way, men!" I looked over, and there was the gallant sounding boat booming away, the unprincipled Tom presiding at the tiller, and my chief sitting by him with the sounding pole, which I had been sent on a fool's errand to fetch. Then the young girl said to me, "Oh, how awful to have to go out on that little boat on such a night. Do you think there's any danger?" I would rather have been stabbed. I went off full of venom to help in the pilot house. By and by, the boat's lantern disappeared, and after an interval, a wee spark glimmered upon the face of the water a mile away. Mr. Thornburg blew the whistle in acknowledgment, backed the steamer out, and made for it. We flew along for a while, then slackened steam and went cautiously gliding toward the spark, and presently Mr. Thornburg exclaimed, "Hello, the buoy lantern's out." He stopped the engines. A moment or two later he said, "Why, there it is again." So he came ahead on the engines once more and rang for the leads. Gradually the water shoaled up and then began to deepen again. Mr. Thornburg muttered, "Well, I don't understand this. I believe that buoy has drifted off the reef. Seems to be a little too far to the left. No matter, it's safest to run over it anyhow." So in that solid world of darkness, we went creeping down on the light, and just as our bows were in the act of plowing over it, Mr. Thornburg seized the bell ropes, rang a startling peal, and exclaimed, "My soul, it's the sounding boat!" A sudden chorus of wild alarms burst out far below, a pause, and then the sound of grinding and crashing followed. Mr. Thornburg exclaimed, "There, the paddle wheels ground the sounding boat to Lucifer matches. Run, see who's killed." I was on the main deck in the twinkling of an eye. My chief and the third mate and nearly all the men were safe. They had discovered their danger when it was too late to pull out of the way. Then, when the great guards overshadowed them a moment later, they were prepared and knew what to do. At my chief's order, they sprang at the right instant, seized the guard, and were hauled aboard. The next moment the sounding yawl swept aft to the wheel and was struck and splintered to atoms. Two of the men and the cub Tom were missing, a fact which spread like wildfire over the boat. The passengers came flocking to the forward gangway, ladies and all, anxious-eyed, white-faced. They talked in awed voices of the dreadful thing. And often and again I heard them say, "Poor fellows, poor boy, poor boy." By this time, the boat's yawl was manned and away to search for the missing. Now a faint call was heard, off to the left. The yawl had disappeared in the other direction. Half the people rushed to one side to encourage the swimmer with their shouts. The other half rushed the other way to shriek to the yawl to turn about. By the callings, the swimmer was approaching, but some said the sound showed failing strength. The crowds massed themselves against the boiler deck railings, leaning over and staring into the gloom, and every faint and fainter cry wrung from them such words as, "Ah, poor fellow, is there no way to save him?" But still the cries held out and drew nearer, and presently the voice said pluckily, "I can make it. Stand by with a rope." What a rousing cheer they gave him! The chief mate took his stand in the glare of a torch basket, a coil of rope in his hand, and his men grouped about him. The next moment, the swimmer's face appeared in the circle of light, and in another one, the owner of it was hauled aboard, limp and drenched, while a cheer on cheer went up. It was that devil Tom. The yawl crew searched everywhere but found no sign of the two men. They probably failed to catch the guard, tumbled back, and were struck by the wheel and killed. Tom had never jumped for the guard at all, but had plunged headfirst into the river and dived under the wheel. It was nothing. I could have done it easy enough, and I said so. But everybody went on just the same, making a wonderful to-do over that ass as if he had done something great. That girl couldn't seem to have enough of that pitiful hero the rest of the trip. But little I cared, I loathed her anyway. The way we came to mistake the sounding board's lantern for the buoy light was this. My chief said that after laying the buoy, he fell away and watched it till it seemed to be secure. Then he took up a position 100 yards below it and a little to one side of the steamer's course, headed the sounding boat upstream, and waited. Having to wait for some time, he and the officer got to talking. He looked up when he judged that the steamer was about on the reef, saw that the buoy was gone, but supposed that the steamer had already run over it. He went on with his talk. He noticed that the steamer was getting very close down to him, but that was the correct thing. It was her business to shave him closely for convenience in taking him aboard. He was expecting to sheer off until the last moment. Then it flashed upon him that she was trying to run him down, mistaking his lantern for the buoy light. So he sang out, "Stand by to spring for the guard, men!" And the next instant, the jump was made. Been reading from Mark Twain's Old Times on the Mississippi, his account of becoming a river pilot and the profession's arcane language from which he took his pen name. The Bookshelf is a production of KPBX in Spokane. Vern Windham, executive producer. I'm Tom Bacon.